Hello.
Hi.
Is it just me and you?
I think so, right now. Let's see, I forget who.
This is Kelly. Who's this?
Oh, hi, Kelly. This is Rosemary. I think we met last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've
Seems to be the
always
only one who's gone. You all
Well,
got
no,
what?
there's others, but I'm sure. But yeah, my mom always taught me to be 15 minutes early was on time. So that's what I do. That's me.
Yeah, that's what I was taught.
Yeah. So how are you doing this week?
You know, I'm retired, so every day's a holiday. How about
Oh,
you?
well, there you go. My husband's retired, so yeah. I know.
What did your husband do
It is
for a living?
Pardon?
What did your husband retire from?
He first from the military and then got working for the government in another form. So,
That's
yeah.
exactly what I did. Isn't that
Oh,
interesting?
really? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Army, Air Force,
Well, I retired from the Army, but then I flew for the Air Force through a government contractor till I retired.
Oh, how neat. Yeah. That's
Yeah.
nice. So where are you guys now? We're in Colorado.
That's where we're at. Now, you're in Colorado Springs, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I forget you did say last week. Where are you guys?
Yeah, we're in Littleton.
Oh, up in Littleton. Okay, yeah.
But I lived in Colorado Springs for over 20 years, so.
Oh, wow. Yeah, well, we've been here actually 30 this year, so. Or 31. I
Wow.
don't. I've lost track.
Wow, isn't
So,
that something?
yeah, it is. But yeah, it.
What branch was your husband in?
He started out in the Air Force, got out, and then he came back in to the Army. So he had that route both ways, and then
Kind of
he
scary because
retired.
that's exactly what I did. I was enlisted in the Air Force for 7 years, and then commissioned in the Army for 17.
Oh my gosh. Well, yeah, he was only in for 4 in the Air Force and then he got out and the economy was bad, so he couldn't get back in the Air Force. He'd been out too long and that's how he ended up in the Army. So, yeah.
Wow, boy.
That's
Put a lot in
basically it.
common there, huh? Gee.
Yeah, no fooling. I'm a counselor by profession. And
Are you a coach?
No, I took some coaching way back when, not through this organization, but I've been kicking around the idea of taking their course, but financially I'm not sure I can afford it right now, so we'll just have to see. But
Yeah.
I've started backing out. I've kicked around the idea of writing a book, and then I really started getting serious back in October, so here I am.
Well, hey, I'm sorry to interrupt. Good gossip. It sounds like you guys are going great.
Dave?
Any thoughts or questions or clarifications from our first seminar or anything that you'd like to talk about briefly before we move into our discussion today about the craft of writing?
What you sent us an email saying that the course workbook is part of the outline. Is that what you meant?
Yes, that was that had been combined. You'll see the exercises and work tools in the outline. It was easier to send it all in one document than a whole separate workbook. So yes, it's incorporated, and that was my mistake because I didn't realize they had done it already, to incorporate that into the annotated outline, and it's more consistent, easier to follow with it being along the lines of each of the four seminars, the exercises and work tools in that segment. So I think it'll be easier to follow. Have you done any of the exercises or work tools to see if they're useful to you?
I haven't
Anyone?
yet, but I took your advice. I've really worked hard on my outline. I've got the title of my book and the outline, and so I'm making progress on it.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've had the same thing. I I went through the first seminar again and compared it to what I had been working on for 2 or 3 months. And
okay.
So far it's clicking. I do have one question.
Would you tell me who you are, and I want to go back to
I'm Rosemary.
Rosemary. Okay. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
okay.
Please.
I've noticed, and I've done a lot of reading of other people's work, I've noticed some of them have what's called a preface. What is that supposed to be exactly?
If you in a nonfiction book, if you want to write, I mean, this is just practical. You can Google it and see what officially it is, but if you think about when you don't probably go into a bricks and mortar bookstore anymore, but you look at it online, and when you see look inside, probably you'll go to the introduction or the preface, especially if it's from the author, because that's the sample. That's like going into Baskin Robbins and getting a little spoon. That's like doing a sample session for a client. You get an introduction of what it's going to be like if you decide to take the journey with this author. So it gives an introduction to not just the topic and how the author is going to approach it, but also to some ways of understanding what it's going to be like to take this journey together, what the voice of the author is, if it sings to you. I'm going to talk a little bit about voice today and give 2 or 3 examples of what voice is. You'll recognize it from the people you follow, but the introduction really does establish that when it's by the author. The preface can be by somebody else, or it can even be by the author if there's a context or a framework that may be important to understand about what's going to unfold. I usually do it. Let me look real quick. Yeah, I just had the second edition of A New Money Story come out within the last couple of weeks, and I do an introduction. I did it myself. I didn't ask somebody else to do it. And it's just a little over a couple of pages, but it kind of tells why I'm interested in this, the backstory. Let me just read you the first 2 sentences of the introduction, and you'll get an idea. You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell my money story to myself in order to know what to change. This statement by an internationally known self-help guru and publisher struck me as both simple and profound. So I tell you what I'm going to talk about, and I tell you why I think it's important, because somebody who I respect a great deal couldn't really get the perspective to describe his own money story. So, hey, if you're interested, read the book, is what that says. So it does that answer your question a little bit?
Yeah, it does. So that, that helped a lot, because I wasn't certain the difference between introduction and preface. But,
and I'm just making that up, which of course, as an author, you have the privilege of doing, and have it serve what you want. But remember, I mentioned every nonfiction book that does well, you look at chapter one, and it begins a story. So the introduction is to introduce the story of working together with the reader on this journey that you're about to take, and then the journey speaks for itself.
Okay. Yeah. That helped. Thank you.
Okay, great. And who was it who spoke first?
This is Kelly. Kelly Spencer.
Okay, yeah, super. Any other thoughts or questions or comments before we move into what we should be talking about?
Nope, ready to go.
Okay, anyone else? Any clarifications from the first seminar. Well, if
this
not,
is Leia. This is Leia.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
I'm not sure if I should have understood this, but I'm not clear as how to phrase a title of my book.
I'm going to talk about that, I think, today in the,
okay, great.
In the craft. The title tells and sells. Think about the title is what compels someone to keep looking at the cover. And then the subtitle tells the reader what the reader is going to get out of reading it, what the benefit is they're going to take away. And the title usually is five words or less, because people make a decision. Well, we'll talk about that, and I'll talk about why, and it won't sound as goofy when I give you a little neuroscience behind it.
Okay, great.
Yeah. Anything else
Thank
or
you.
Anyone else? Okay, I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I'll reserve some time at the end if there are any questions or thoughts or additional comments you want to make to add them. Okay, we're going to talk about the craft of writing and look at some aspects of that. You learn to do something by doing it. And writing is no different. You learn to write by producing a certain number of words on a regular basis. You learn to become an author by rewriting. And I think I included this in the outline. Mark Twain said this really simply. Writing is easy. All you have to do is cross out the wrong words. So you're an author of your life story and your written story. So here are some reflections as we talk about the craft of writing. Think about these three questions. What is it you do uniquely well better than anyone else? And since you're doing it yourself, you don't have to be hesitant. You don't have to be humble. Who's your audience? Now, it's not everybody. Remember, when you worked on niche, you wanted to coach everybody about anything, and that didn't work. So you had to rethink, okay, maybe I'll really look at what niche is. Who's your audience? In setting your writing goals, be clear about three things. What your readers need from you, what you want to offer them, and what things you understand that you want to convey to the reader. Now, beginning by looking at your experience as a writer and yourself to understand your motivation for publishing. Here are 12 and counting. People want to write for a bunch of different reasons. Here are some. To share, to disseminate your knowledge, experience, and message to readers. As a gift to clients. And think about these different purposes and how that might determine, as we'll talk about later, how you go about publishing. As a premium with some other offer, for example, an ebook as a bonus for subscribing to your blog or some initial program you have. To publish with a traditional publisher using an agent to establish a national or international presence as an author. To make money by selling the book yourself. To use your book to make money for other services and products. To establish yourself as an expert. To enhance your client base. As a springboard for seminars, workshops, presentations, retreats. To develop mastermind groups or discussion groups, including those based on your book. 11, to make a difference in people's lives. In our own small way, we each want to change the world. Come on now, you admit it. You don't have to say it out loud, and you're on mute, so you can even. Words, here's Tom Stoppard, a British playwright. I saw him interviewed last night, curiously enough. He put it this way. Words are sacred. They deserve respect. If you get the right ones in the right order, you can nudge the world a little. And finally, to leave a legacy. Here's how the dedication of one such book, A Memoir on Parenting, can sound. This is the dedication. To Ryan and Lauren, I hope there will be a time when you will find at least some of this book interesting, though if I've done a good job of parenting, not revealing anything really new. I can't know whether or if it will be tomorrow or a dozen years of tomorrows from now. Know that whenever it is, I will be loving you. May you walk through all your days with love remembered and love renewed. Dad. That's from my book, Making Memories. I'll use that later as an example of one publishing option. Now, I want to talk a little bit, as I mentioned, about voice. Definite voice is conversational voice. Ideally, what you write sounds like you talking. The writer gives us a sense that we're listening to an empathic storyteller, a skilled raconteur, rather than simply looking at words on paper. Now, this is different than the usual advice, or the too simple advice, write the way you talk. Voice involves more than accurate transcription. A true essence of conversation comes from attentive listening and dedicated revision. Transcribing talk is not writing, but it's one technique to help cultivate voice. Some writers speak into recording devices, like a digital dictation device, to let their voices flow and to hear themselves at the same time. One step in your editing process is to read your words out loud. Then you can recast a word or sentence that doesn't sound quite right. It's often the final step of editing is to read your stuff out loud. Here's an example. Barbara McClintock, awarded a Nobel Prize for her study of gene transposition in corn plants, said she made her discoveries by listening to what the corn told her. She described respecting the life and presence of the corn and, as she put it, letting it come. She said she learned the stories of the plants. She heard them. She watched their daily green journeys of growth and came to know the plants in a way a healer or mystic would have known them from the inside by hearing the inner voices of corn speaking to her as another being. Now, even in previously contributing to the psychoanalytic literature on empathy as a scientific way of listening, it never occurred to me that an ear of corn had much to say. I suspect that if I mused out loud to a colleague at that time that some vegetables were talking to me, he would or she would definitely call the guys in the white coats. For Barbara, though, it was a true exchange. From this perspective of voice, consider this passage. I think you'll hear voice immediately. I used this passage, which also fits with my philosophy of coaching, as a preface in the last book I wrote as a psychoanalyst, Integrating Body Self and Psychological Self. This quote is from Anatoly Broillard's Intoxicated by My Illness. This is what he said. My ideal doctor, I can imagine entering my condition, looking around it from the inside like an ideal landlord with a tenant, trying to see how he could make the premises more livable. He would look around, holding me by the hand, and he would figure out what it is like to be me. Then he would try to find certain advantages in the situation. He can turn disadvantages into advantages. He would see the genius of my illness. He would mingle his demon with mine. We would wrestle with my fate together like Rupert and Birkin in the library and D.H. Lawrence's Women in Love. I would also like a doctor who enjoyed me. I want to be a good story for him, to give him some of my art in exchange for his. Here are a couple of other brief examples of voice, because when you follow someone, if you really like them, you can see anything, even when it's not attributed to them, you can see anything in a sentence or two and know it's them. Here's from Oliver Sacks, and this is from The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. My work, my life, is all with the sick, but the sick and their sickness drives me to thoughts which perhaps I might not otherwise have had, so much that I am compelled to ask with Nietzsche, as for sickness, are we not also tempted to ask whether we could get along without it? And to see the questions it raises as fundamental in nature. Constantly my patients drive me to question, and constantly my questions drive patients. Thus, in the stories or studies which follow, there is a continual movement from one to the other. If you can imagine that with an English accent. And here's one more. This is from Annie Dillard. When you write, you lay out a line of words. The line of words is a miner's pick, a woodcarver's gauge, a surgeon's probe. You wield it, and it digs a path you follow. Soon you find yourself deep in new territory. Is it a dead end, or have you located the real subject? You will know tomorrow, or this time next year. You make the path boldly and follow it fearfully. You go where the path leads. At the end of the path, you find a box canyon. You hammer out reports, dispatch bulletins. That's from Annie Dillard's The Writing Life. So hear how they sound. And if you read more and have read more, it sounds exactly like them. So let's look at designing every part of your book. Now, we'll revisit this in a moment in the book outline, but these are just some aspects to think about in terms of preparation. The title, as I mentioned, five words or less that tells and sells, and I want to revisit why that is in a moment. Subtitle, the promise, the benefits described. The silver bullet, for this is for you, a clear, sharply focused description of your book that you can recite in the time that it takes an elevator to go from the ground to the fifth floor. In other words, that you can do in a couple of sentences. So as you edit, assume you're on a really fast elevator. It should clearly explain what your book is about, why it's special, and the specific benefits it will provide to readers. Mission statement, a 7 to 9 word statement of the purpose of your book, and the back cover, ideally written before you write your book. It's a compelling ad copy of benefits to the readers. Look at the backs of some of the books that have been important to you. The book introduction, which we've already discussed. The problem you address for your audience, why you wrote the book, its purpose, its benefits, and how you're going to present it. It's basically you introducing yourself as an author, and yeah, this is what we're going to talk about. The table of contents, the book outline, and then in the beginning, before the book, the query letter, the lead, the four parts, the lead, the body, the bio, and the close. Even if you don't plan to use an agent, because that's only one of the, I think, 9 different ways of publishing that we're going to talk about, a traditional agent and a traditional publishing house. It will help you conceptualize an overview and the intended impact of your book. So let's talk about the nonfiction book proposal. Why is this important, even if you don't plan to submit it to a traditional publishing house? Because the book proposal is the business plan of your book. It's the blueprint for the architect. The business plan for the organization. You need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. Setting a goal will enhance motivation. Establishing strategies will facilitate focus. You know from coaching that what we offer our clients is not helping them look at their goals. Everybody has the same goal. Winners and losers have the same goals. What we offer as coaches is a system, a map. When you have a map, you know where you are, where you're going, how to measure progress along the way, what's detour and what's distraction. The book proposal is your map for the book, to have the end in mind from the beginning. Lewis Carroll put this very simply. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" responded the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." Basically, the cat said, if you don't know where you're going, any map will do. Develop an organizing idea with a substantial center. What's your book about? Why does it exist? You'll communicate both of these notions again and again in various ways throughout your book. Beside the title, the subtitle, the header sentences, headline sentences, the chapter subtitles, all fit the brand, the essence of your book. So the nonfiction book proposal is a tool to help you organize and elaborate your concept of a book. Another purpose is to tell the publisher, if you decide to go this route, about your book, why it's important, why you're the one to write it, and why it's going to be successful. So a good book starts with a good idea. This is capturing that idea. The book's merit should address these fundamental issues. Why would somebody want to read your book? Who's your target audience? What's your niche here? The target audience. What is your unique hook? And in the subject that you're going to cover, what's your unique hook that isn't already out there that other people don't already know? Can the hook and the message support an entire book? And finally, what will I be telling my readers they don't already know? You know, look at how these questions are very interconnected. So let's look at these components of the book proposal more specifically and kind of talk it through, and I think you'll get a better idea and kind of a working concept, I hope. First, the title and subtitle. I'll take it in the order that I mentioned initially. The title, conventional wisdom said, contain no more than 5 words. The reason? A longer title requires the reader to think instead of feel. The title should create a instant motivating visualization. And we know that more people think in pictures and learn in a visual way than auditory and kinesthetic put together. So the title should trigger positive images, not negative ones. The focus should also be positive rather than negative, not the avoidance of a negative. Neuroscience tells us we get what we focus on, whether that's negative or positive, not what we want. So focus on the positive. The title should pass the airplane test. Now, this is my personally devised test that came to me when a publisher who I knew asked me to write a blurb for the dust jacket of a book. And I knew of the author, and I knew the publisher really well. So I said, well, I'll be happy to, but first tell me what the title of the book is. And he told me, and I said, I can't do that. I said, I'll be happy to review the book and write a blurb or a testimonial if it has a different title, but that one doesn't pass the airplane test. And he said, okay, Dave, what's the airplane test? And I said, well, if I'm on an airplane and somebody sees the book I'm reading and looks at the cover and the title, I don't want to be embarrassed by the title or feel stupid to be reading something with a goofy title or negative implications, or somebody will wonder if I've got the problem that the title promises the book will fix. He thanked me, had the author change the title, sent me the review copy, and it went on to be a bestseller. He changed the title substantially. I don't know if that fit with bestseller, but people on airplanes wouldn't be embarrassed to read that book. And there are exceptions to everything. Here's one exception to the rule of five words or less for a title. It's a bestseller itself by child and adolescent psychologist Dr. Anthony Wolf. Here's the title, not the subtitle. Just here's the title. Get Out of My Life, But First Would You Drop Me and Cheryl Off at the Mall? So there are exceptions. To the overview, a compelling overview of your book, 1 to 2 pages in length, should communicate what your book is about and show the essential worth and marketability of a book and why it's not just a magazine article, a newspaper story, or a series of blogs. The overview should be a clear, concise statement of four elements: what the book is about, this is in your outline, why it should be written, how you're going to write it, and why you're the best person to write it. 3, this is going to require some research. Markets. This section should contain information about who will buy your book, who you're writing the book for, why the book should exist, and your strategy to sell it. You can't underestimate your strategy of selling it, the connections that you have, and the ways that you'll go about actively marketing it if you do traditional publishing. But you're going to have to think about it however you publish, because you're going to want your book to be dispersed as widely as possible, to be in as many hands as possible. So you're going to have to be, however you publish it, whatever way you choose, you're going to be doing active marketing of your book. 4, the competition. The competition section spells out the results of your research and assessment about the viability of your proposal, the competition, complementary books, and competitive ones as well, and how you're going to support the idea of the book's existence, considering all of this. What's unique about your book, in other words? 5, promotion. What will you do to help promote and sell your book, including maybe some of these specific points to think about, or if you're doing a traditional proposal, you'll have to spell it out. Local, regional, national presentations, perhaps hiring a publicist, somebody who's expert at doing this. What kind of positions with network promotions do you have? Faculty, consulting, memberships with marketing impact, electronic or regular mail contacts, collaborative promotional affiliate partners, interviews for the book release, articles that you have available, guest appearances that you have on blogs or podcasts. There are people who specialize. I have a client who retained a service to get him on podcasts, and in 1 year, he was on 25 really outstanding podcasts, and that launched what he was interested in selling. First, his new business, and then his book. 6, the author, and this is still the proposal, 6 in the proposal, the author's background. Emphasize your background and experience as it relates to the book. And this is where the work comes in. 7 is the chapter outline. This section, its organization and persuasion, is crucial. It should contain a table of contents and a chapter-by-chapter outline with chapter abstracts. The chapter-by-chapter outline consists of a synopsis of each chapter, as little as 2 to 3 paragraphs, maybe up to a page each. These chapter abstracts allow you to show what you can do without having to write the book. This is your blueprint. This is also the work that you put in. There are a number of authors who indicate that by the time they've done the work and the research to construct the book outline, especially the chapter outline. They've written a third to, I've heard a couple of people say even half, but they've written a significant portion of the book already because they just have to elaborate on what they've already done research on, probably whatever their style is, dictated or typed, a lot of information from research, from interviews, from whatever they do, and they put it in the outline in a summarized way. And eight, the sample chapter. You don't have to write an entire book if you decide to go with a traditional publisher and a traditional agent. You just have to send the book outline and a sample chapter. The sample chapter is usually chapter one, but it simply proves you can do the job. So you engage the reader from the first sentence. Look at some of the recent nonfiction bestsellers. Not only does chapter one in each book begin with a story to engage the reader to capture the essence of the message, but the first sentence is usually compelling. I've heard two publishers and three agents say this. I can tell by the first page, and that's like double space times New Roman 12, this is like 200 to 250 words. I can tell by the first page if I'm going to represent this book or if I'm going to publish this book. One person, an agent, said, I read the first paragraph, and I can tell at that point if I'm going to represent the person. So the nonfiction book proposal probably runs somewhere between 20 to 40 pages, plus a sample chapter. The book proposal is not just a sales tool for the writer, but it's your teaching tool. It's your game plan, your superstructure. The book proposal serves as your map because it requires you to understand the meaning of your book, to articulate what the book is about, and it requires you to think about why you're writing it, why anyone would be interested. So this is why I say, when you decide what to write, write about what you're most interested to learn, because this is going to make it exciting and sustaining. Whatever you write about, you're going to end up in a different place. These are demands you should already be placing on yourself when you first consider writing a book. In fact, the first month or two of creating a book may be about investigating your idea and writing your book proposal. Here are still, in the originals of these were introduced many years ago, the two best books for writing a book proposal. And you'll usually get one or the other as the favorite of any specific author. One is How to Write a Book Proposal by Michael Larson. And this is in your outline. And the second is Write the Perfect Book Proposal. And that's by Jeff and Deborah Herman, H-E-R-M-A-N-N. I like the Write the Perfect Book Proposal because it has, I think, 10 examples of proposals that have been sent to publishers that worked, that resulted in published books. Here's one other book that you might want to use as reference. This has been called The Bible of Writers. It's simply called The Art of Writing by William Zinsser, Z-I-N-S-S-E-R. So here are seven habits of successful writers. One, create a specific plan, including your schedule for writing. This is your map. Stick with it no matter what. Sometimes one of the most important things in life, as well as in writing, is to show up, to have a system. Now, this schedule is simply a writing plan. It doesn't have to be detailed or onerous. It may look like some version of one of these. I'm going to write for 2 hours, 3 days a week, specify the days between 8 and 10 p.m. I'll draft 500 words of writing 5 days a week. I'll create two chunks a week. We'll talk about that in a minute. I will create an outline of the book by fill in the date. I will create an annotated outline by fill in the date. Focusing on a simple, specific action plan sets up the potential for your effectiveness and mastery. Divide up your work. Focus on and complete one thing at a time. There's always something you can focus on. Here's a story that kind of illustrates that. During my specialty training in psychiatry, one of my first-year supervisors had a really puzzling picture on the wall. It was a photograph in which everything was just out of focus. And I met with him every week. I'd glance at the photo. And finally, by the end of the year, I mustered up. I said, "Steve, tell me about that photograph. What's going on?" He said, "Look carefully, Dave. What do you see?" And I said, I finally walked over to the photograph to get a closer look. Closer didn't help. It still seemed out of focus. I saw no particular aesthetic value in it, and I had some experience and a considerable interest in photography, even a publication. But none of that helped. I said, "Steve, the only thing I notice is there's only one branch of one tree in focus in the entire picture." He nodded. He said, "That's why I have it hanging there. It's my reminder that while things may seem confusing and blurry, there's always at least one thing that you can have in focus and see clearly." That's why he was a great supervisor for first-year residents. Two, when you write, write. Don't combine editing and writing, as we talked moments ago. Writing and editing, two different mindsets, two different parts of the brain. Plan separate times for each task. Three, take one step at a time. Have a small, specific, definable goal. Write in small bursts. The first draft may be done at various times, bit by bit, and may be a compilation of several stacks of pages from various times. Here's an example of that. Terry Fox ran the Marathon of Hope, a cross-Canada run of 3,339 miles. Because he had an artificial leg, his running style was a shuffle and a hop. He managed, though, to average 24 miles a day, completed the run in 143 days. He was asked how he kept going when he was exhausted and knew he had still thousands of miles ahead. He said, "I just keep running to the next telephone pole." Now, he knew where the telephone poles ended at the end of the Marathon of Hope, but that was his focus, one telephone pole at a time. Find your most effective way of writing and stick to it. Whether it's the computer, writing longhand on a yellow tab, pad, or dictating for later transcription, do what fits your learning and creativity style. Also pay attention to your best time of the day for the creative process of writing and the best time of the day for the most objective work of editing. Pay attention to your biorhythms. In Texas, here's how that sounds. It's easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. Five, read your work aloud. As I mentioned, this can be a very effective element in editing, a way of listening on another level. If possible, join a writer's group to hear your work and other work read by others. Some of the best time I've ever spent for writing, I did two University of Iowa writers' workshops and a couple of local ones where writers get together, read brief vignettes of their work, and everybody else comments, and you don't get to say anything. Or somebody else reads your work, even better, because you don't get to pause in the right way and say, "Oh, wait, you should have emphasized that work." And it's more objectivity. And there's going to be a writer's group in your area, wherever that is. It can be well worth your time because it also prompts you to have something ready for it, kind of to avoid embarrassment, but you'll have to do your own motivation. Six, do adequate research. Effective writers know that good research is about pursuing questions and information sources themselves, as well as resorting to books, websites, reports, interviews, journals, various ways of getting information. And one way that makes it really easy now is simply to do Google Alerts. I have Google Alerts for over a couple of dozen different subjects. So I have once a day delivered to my email the title, the summary in an abstract sentence or two of what the article is about, and then the link. If it appeals to me, I'll click on the link. If the article appeals to me, I'll copy it and stack them up and read it one at a time that I'm doing that. And that can be very, very useful as a way of gathering information, because Google Alerts will include everything from newspaper articles to scientific journals to TED Talks, whatever it is on that topic will be delivered to your box. And seven, read the writing of others. We learn by reading. Reading of what instructs us as well as what stimulates. Read from other related fields. Stretch yourself. You'll find your own best balance for reading and writing. So here, since you ask, are the top six mistakes successful writers avoid. One, avoid passive sentence construction. So as you read and edit your work, convert passive verbs into action language whenever possible. Two, be clear, specific, simple, and humane. Those are the four qualities of good writing, also happen to be the four qualities of good speaking, from William Zender, The Art of Writing. Significant work goes into keeping it simple and making it look easy. Keep the burden of the clarity of communication. Don't shift it to the reader or listener. And we now know from neuroscience that we can attend to and retain up to 10 words at a time. So that emphasizes the clear, specific, and simple portion of that. Three, show, don't tell your audience. Use stories, metaphors. Combining a good story, right brain, with pointing out the story's lesson, left brain, engages both sides of the brain for balanced learning. People accept ideas more readily when their minds are in story mode as opposed to a more analytical mindset. Show, don't tell. Melville didn't write a story about whaling. He wrote a unique action and dialogue drama about one guy and one fish. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who with Crick discovered DNA, he said, you know, I can remember something when I fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. Four, keep the eye to a minimum in order to acknowledge and engage your reader. Five, lose the jargon and the fancy phrases. Hemingway believed that 1 to 2 syllable words worked way better than longer ones. So don't try to impress your audience with your intellect or vocabulary or research. Your reader wants a savvy friend who explains things in a down-to-earth way, oh, and also happens to be an expert. Six, be a good storyteller. When you carefully craft a speech or tell a story, the art lies in evoking the desired emotional response from the listener or reader. Rather than expressing yourself or telling the reader or the listener what the reaction should be, you enable the reader to have that emotional experience. We can learn best from the poets who offer their art to the reader or listener as a doorway to the recipient's own experience. One of the storytellers I studied, a mentor in storytelling when I first made my transition to coaching, told of an experience he had going through O'Hare in Chicago. A woman stopped him to say how much she had enjoyed his presentation 2 or 3 years before that. She just recognized him, how it stayed with her for all of that time. He asked her to remind him what he had talked about in that presentation. And she said, I don't remember exactly what you talked about, but I'll always remember that story you told. Here's an exercise. A chunking exercise. A chunk is a piece of writing about the size of a newspaper column that looks at a single subject. So it can be one or two pages. It can be something you dictate, if that's your style. So first exercise is write a single chunk. Treat the single subject in a complete self-contained way. So this may be an anecdote, a vignette, an exercise, a description of an event, a complete thought, or a case study. It should be on the subject related to your book. Second exercise, write four more chunks. You'll see the chunks are the building blocks of nonfiction books. Exercise three, fit your chunks into the outline. See what the chunks illuminate or describe or further a section of a specific chapter of your book. And exercise four, plan a month of writing. After you've written five chunks, fitted them into the outline, you may want to revise your outline. After a revision, decide what chunks to write next. For these, you'll be more aware of what you want to write and can make a writing schedule. And I'm not saying plan a month of writing in terms of taking off for a month. Plan whatever your schedule and specific map is for writing. If it's for 1 hour, three times a day at a specific time, do that for a month, but work on chunks while you do that. So here are some important areas for focus for the serious writer. The mission statement of your book. And think about in business, a mission statement is an organization's primary purpose, the strategies to achieve that purpose, and the fundamental values. So a mission statement clarifies and gives meaning to the purpose and the structure. A personal mission statement can do that for your clients. But consider the mission statement for your book. Let's apply the three components of a mission statement. Actually, let's say four. I think that's what's in your outline. Four elements: ideals, purpose, strategies, and goals. Ideals are the core values that motivate and guide you, defining the important elements of what you're going to convey in the book. Two, purpose, what you want to accomplish, the benefit the readers get that are consistent with your ideals. Strategy, the art and science of a plan of action. This has to do with how you're going to conceive and craft and deliver your book. And the goals, remember, a very useful acronym for goals is the acronym SMART goals: specific, measurable, attainable, realistic, time-bound. Each deserves its own specificity. So, create a mission statement for yourself as a writer. It can guide you, remind you what you are meant to do. It can be a compass to guide your story, both to completion and fulfillment. Write it down. Look at it each time before you begin writing. I'll share my mission statement with you. To live, love, contribute, and play with absolute passion. A business plan for your book, the book proposal. Third, a timetable, a calendar of completion of each aspect of your book. A daily schedule. Your writing office, a space of your own, as Virginia Woolf emphasized. Your tools, whatever adequate support from computer to business stationery to digital dictation device, whatever is going to support your style of writing. Seven, continuing education in writing, in your subject matter, in everything related, even related disciplines to your writing, and ultimately in marketing. And eight, as I mentioned, a writer's group. I've had personally huge leaps forward in participating in writer's groups. That can be, I think, immensely helpful. And finally, I want to just do a step back and and discuss just for a moment your belief systems. If you want to change your life, first change your mind. How do you do an inventory of beliefs that can be limiting or compromising or enhancing and fulfilling? And analogous to impressionistic painting, each of your experience is a dab of paint on a pontilist canvas. Only when you step back and view the entire picture do you recognize that the points form a pattern of a particular segment of life, and the segments have their own unity. You create each experience, the patterns, and the composite image. Each is a different level of awareness. And remember this, you're always free to change your mind. Always free to change your beliefs and core assumptions about who and what you are. Changing your mind not only alters your brain, it also transforms your life. But first you have to be aware. That's why coaches are in existence and why people hire coaches, to be aware of and help the client write a life story or business or wellness or money, whatever it is, to write a better story, one that's more fulfilling, more successful, better for them, to enhance their performance in doing this. Consider this. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. Let me say that a different way. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. We always create the outside to match the inside. Show me clutter, I'll show you blocked energy that desires relief. Now, the secret here is that an obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Here's an example. I saw a cartoon of a dog straining at its leash, barking relentlessly, ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. Now, in the next frame, the cat was anything but shabby, mean, as big as the dog, ferocious looking. But the dog continued to strain its leash, let me just at him, barking for a... All of a sudden, in the middle of a vigorous bark, the leash snapped, leaving the dog free to go after the cat. He looked astonished, scared to death. He quickly ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his ferocious, just let me at him. So, when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to write, reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching perspective applied to you and that statement right now. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. We have a few minutes. I'm interested in thoughts or questions. Would anyone like to put in a single sentence the most important thing that you're taking away from this seminar for you?
David, this is Danny Bedoni. Hi, everybody.
Hey, how are you?
Great. This is fantastic. So my takeaway is the editing and the writing, because I was writing and editing, I'm writing and editing, and I did not know that my brain had to be in two spaces. So thank you. This kind of makes me flow better on the writing. So thank you for this. It's a huge takeaway.
Super. Thank you. That's great. Thanks, Danny. Who else? Your takeaway. It doesn't have to be eloquent or important, but if it's important for you, what's your takeaway that you're going to remember? How we ask at the end of a coaching session, how would you summarize what you're taking away in a single sentence, and then ask, based on that, what do you commit to do? That summary is really important. Mm-hmm. It's what we know now about about the importance of putting something in an output channel to complete the story and make it more memorable. The simplest study that illustrates this, University of Waterloo, had two groups of people matched as much as they could, read the same passage from a book, half read it out loud, half read it silently. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on a test that followed. They had simply put it in an output channel. So I want to ask again, what's the most important thing that you're taking away from this discussion? Anyone?
This is Kip.
Hey, Skip. How are you, Kip?
Hey, I'm doing great, man.
Super.
I remember you saying, write as though it's for your grandmother. So keeping things simple and not being eloquent with, you know, the jargon, that's very important for me. And I think you said something about being the person's friend who's also an expert.
Okay, great. Yeah, thanks, Kip. Super. Who else?
This is Kelly. I say,
go ahead,
take away is make a plan and stick to the plan.
Yeah, I just did a mentor coaching session with someone who had a very successful business and sold it for an incredible amount of money, and that's exactly what we talked about. Now that he was looking at the days being a blank slate instead of the structure that he had, and I said, would you like to hear a single sentence that is really the secret to planning and living the rest of your life? And he said, well, sure. And I said very simply that whatever you experience, you create yourself. All you ever have to do is the next right thing. And all you ever have to do in life is the next right thing is basically a principle that we operate on in coaching, because out of all the possibilities, we get someone to focus on what they do next. This is the beauty of having a map, because a map allows you to look at one thing and all the multitude of things you don't have to focus on. That's what a focus does. It helps to align the energy field of the brain into one area, one focus. All the things you don't have to pay attention to, you don't waste energy on. And that's why, for example, as an application, mindfulness meditation is a model of focus. You focus on your breath and the experience of relaxation. Anything else that appears, like a thought, you let it go and refocus on your breath. And some writers do that before they began creating, to do a meditation and focus and to enter a state of mind that they find beneficial for writing. Anybody else want to add something? We're out of time, and I want to respect that, but are there any other things that you have that will be you'd like to say is what you're taking away? It will help you, and it'll help all of us too, I think, as we've heard, but what are you taking away? Anyone dare venture? If you think of anything, or for those of you who are doing the recording and playback, if you think of anything, fire it off to me in an email. I think it'll be helpful to do that. So thanks very much for all of your energy and attention. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time, and we'll follow roughly. I'm working from the same basic outline you are, so we'll look at Seminar 3, and I'll be talking from that as well. So bring that with you if you print it out. So thanks very much. Take good care of yourselves. And until next week. Bye now. See you guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dave.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.